Well, you know what they say, I could tell you, but I'd have to kill you. No, I mean, the truth of the matter is like this. The truth of the matter is that in many, many ways...
Rabbi, can you repeat the question?
Yeah, he was just asking, Lurianic, we talk about Lurianic Kabbalah, that means the mystical system that was developed by the Arizal, Rav Yitzchak Luria, right, in Tzfat. The Arizal died at the age of 39. He only spent a year and a half in Eretz Yisrael. He died extremely young. And yet, all of the great Kabbalah is primarily based on the teachings of the Arizal. And the question becomes, he lived in the 1500s. What did he create? Did he create something that did not exist previously? And what exactly was the uniqueness of his contribution? Again, I myself am not in a position to fully tell you this. Basically, though, the Ari created, not created, he didn't create, obviously, but the Ari described in very, very great detail what is called the Seder of Hishtalshalus. Hishtalshalus is how do you get from the pure spiritual nature of God to the physical, tangible universe. Now again, we just take it for granted God created the world, but for the Kabbalists, this was a tremendous, tremendous enigma, that how do you go from spirituality to physicality? Moreover, the Arizal started off with a question, which is kind of almost a child's question, but to the Ari, this was a tremendously difficult problem, and that is, Hashem is everywhere. We say, Molei Chol Aretz Kvodo. The whole universe is filled with God. And indeed, the universe is situated within God. God is the called Makom, because he is the place in which the universe is located. So the question is, given the fact that two objects cannot occupy the identical space, how can I be here? How can the table be here? How can the rock be here? Where is God? Is God not occupying that particular space? This was a real, real, real problem. And the Ari developed, and again, in great, great Arichas, we're talking about volumes and volumes, the concept of Tzimtzum, that in order for Hashem to create the universe, Hashem had to contract within himself to make room for everything else to exist. And therefore, creation is not really an act of making, it is an act of withdrawal and concealment. Now, this is has many, many profound repercussions. This is the concept of Bechira, that God withdraws, and that creates the freedom to act against Hashem. That also is the idea of humility, that a Kishbarchan is humility contracted within himself. But the problem basically is, and again, I'm giving you a one-line thing, this is volumes and volumes and volumes in terms of the process of creation and how it goes through the different worlds, the worlds of emanation, and which is Atzilus, and the worlds of Bria, creation, and Yetzirah, formation, until we get to this physical world. And the whole essence of the world, therefore, involves concealment of the divine. And our job is to try to uncover the sparks of holiness and the light. So, this issue of Tzimtzum is really one of the big, big machlokesim. In fact, paradoxically, this may have been the biggest single machlokes between the Vilna Gaon and the Hasidic movement. Now, we tend to look at the Machlokas as dealing with Torah versus David, tefillah, etc., doing the mitzvahs versus the feeling of the mitzvahs. But many say that the real Machlokas was such an arcane issue that according to the Vilna Gaon's understanding of the Ari, we say Tzimtzum is Kipshuto. God literally withdrew, allowing for physicality to exist. The Hasidim, particularly the Baal HaTanya, said that was impossible, because then you're saying God is not here, and therefore he went the other way around, that God is in everything, and Tzimtzum is only the appearance of withdrawal, but it is not the reality of withdrawal. The Vilna Gaon maintained that was idolatry and paganism. To say that God is everywhere means I'm God. And therefore there was a bitter, bitter machlokas which involved Ikre Amuna. Some people, Rav Dessler, in the 20th century, tried to say, if you really look at the Vilna Gaon and the Baal HaTanya and the Nefesh HaChayim, Rav Chaim Volozhin, if you look at it in a deep way, they really all say the same thing ultimately, and it's just a question of terminology. But when Rav Dessler wrote that, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, who would seem to be a big expert on Tanya at least, sent a long, long letter, Chas v'Shalom. There was a major machlokas between them and the like. So if we had to talk about one line, what was the Ari's major innovative chiddush? But again, it's almost trivial to say it that way. It was the idea of Tzimtzum, that creation comes from the concealment of the divine, and that is the nature of Hester Panim. And the concept, the role of a human being is to bring out the holiness that exists in concealment and in veils. Now, you need to know a few other complications. The Arizal did not write anything. In fact, the only writing we have from the Ari is a receipt on a purchase of pepper. The Ari was a merchant. He made a parnasa too. And we have his signature on a pepper purchase. But none of the Ari's voluminous writings were written by the Ari. The Ari didn't write anything, and the Ari said it was impossible for him to write, because everything was so connected to everything, and he saw everything at the same time, he couldn't write it sequentially. He was just like a Mayan, like a gushing, a spring that would just describe and say things. So the Ari's teachings were taken down by his Talmidim. Now the Iker Talmud of the Ari was Rav Chaim Vital, who was actually older than the Arizal, but a little bit older, but he became a Talmud of the Arizal, and therefore the books, which are around 20, 25 volumes we have that are called Kisvei HaAri, are really the writings of Rav Chaim Vital, just like Lahavdil Mea Havdalos, in the Greek philosophy. Socrates did not write anything. Anything of Socrates is from Plato. So too, Lahavdil, everything of the Ari is from Chaim Vital. But what's a little complicated is that the Ari did have other Talmidim who also wrote their understandings of Lurianic Kabbalah. Rabbi Yisrael Sarug is one example. And in the course of time, those writings, people stopped learning them, and they only learned the Ari through Rabbi Chaim Vital. But it turns out that some of the other Mekubalim had different understandings of the Arizal. And a lot of those other understandings are not in published books. They are in manuscripts that are still used by real Mekubalim. There aren't that many, but there are a few real Mekubalim. One outstanding example of a published work that is based on non-Rav Chaim Vital Lurianic Kabbalah, it's actually a very, very famous book. It's a famous book among people who know Sfarim, but very few people learn it. This is the Asara Mamoros of Rav Menachem Azaria Mipano, who is an Italian Kabbalist. And Rav Huttner writes that this is an extremely important work because it is kemat the only sefer that gives you an alternative meaning of the Ari's Kabbalah outside of the Maskeret of Rav Chaim Vital. And in fact, many point out, again, this is stuff that's really beyond me, but I know some of the bibliographic information, that the Vilna Gaon, who was a great Mekubal, is cholek in many places on the Kisvei HaAri. He's cholek. And people say, oh, the Gra did not accept the Ari, but if you go into the Ian of it, you actually see he is cholek on Rav Chaim Vital's understanding of the Ari. And in fact, the Vilna Gaon himself plugged into the alternative understandings of the Ari. So the Vilna Gaon was not cholek on the Ari. The Vilna Gaon was cholek on Rabbi Chaim Vital's understanding of the Ari. And in that connection as well, I should mention Rabbi Yashiv's grandfather, Rav Shlomo Yashiv, who was a great, great Kabbalist, who was nifter, I guess, the beginning of the 20th century. He wrote a Kabbalistic sefer, maybe the last great sefer of Kabbalah, the Leshem Shebo V'Yachlama, the Baal HaLeshem. And the Baal HaLeshem is essentially an elaboration of the Vilna Gaon system, which is Cholek and Rav Chaim Vital, and he makes the point that he was conversant with the other traditions of the Arizal. Okay, so that's kind of just a general idea. But Tzimtzum is considered to be the main Chiddush of the Ari, but then we have to discuss all sorts of how did it happen, when did it happen, what was the exact process. This takes up literally volumes and volumes and volumes. By the way, you know, if you ever look at the Nefesh HaChaim, Rav Chaim Volozhin is safer. So everybody, not everybody, Halvai, everybody, but the part that is studied in the yeshiva world is primarily Shar Dalit, which talks about the importance of Torah learning. And it's almost like the mission statement of the yeshiva world. But if you look in Shar Aleph, which talks about what our mitzvahs accomplish, etc., is primarily about Tzimtzum. And in Shar Aleph, there's a huge, huge footnote from Rav Chaim Volozhin, his son, Rav Yitzchak Volozhin. That's like 50 pages, a 50-page footnote, which is very, very heavily with Kabbalah. And that's also devoted to the idea of Tzimtzum. So it's all sold in there. And of course, the Sefer HaTanya is devoted that way as well. And it would be very, very interesting if you ever get in a position to learn it Be'iyun, to read the sections of Tanya and read the sections of Nefesh HaChaim. They are deliberately in dialogue. The Nefesh HaChaim was written in response to certain statements in the Tanya. They're actually talking to each other, although they don't mention, nobody mentions any names.
So in last week's Parsha, Yaakov blesses Ephraim and Manasseh to be like fish, and Rashi says one of the reasons was because of the evil eye. So I know many other religions believe in the evil eye, so what role does the evil eye play in Judaism? To what extent can it harm someone? They say that some people say it only harms you if you believe in it. Is that true?
That's also a factor. The Gemara mentions in many, many places that there's something called Ayin Hara, the evil eye. And in fact, there's even a statement that Rava said that 99 out of 100 people die not because of their sins or their time has come, but because of the Ayin Hara that's on them. Now, what is Ayin Hara, evil eye? In primitive cultures, evil eye was thought to be almost something that comes out of your eye, like rays, you know, like Superman has X-ray vision or heat vision, right? So evil eye, you know, burn you up. And if you read it superficially, when sometimes the Gemara talks about a certain chacham saw something bad and he looked at you and you got burnt up. Right? That's how it's described. But, and you know, who knows? But the way Rav Dessler tries to give more of a psychological, spiritual understanding of Ayin Hara. And he says the following. He says that a human being is called an Olam Katan, a miniature world. And a human being is made in the image of God. So mankind has the power, has certain divine powers, of course, infinitesimally smaller than God. But, you know, we can create, we can destroy. And just as Hashem created the universe with speech, so too we can build people up or destroy them with speech. That's the idea of Lashon Hara, that our words have power to change reality. All of that is because of the divine power of our soul. We are godly. God creates and destroys by his word. We create and destroy by our words, right? So by the same token, he says like this, looking at somebody really means judging them, scrutinizing them, right? When I look at you, what I'm doing is I'm thinking to myself, do you really deserve, let's say a person, Ayin Hara normally comes in when a person is ostentatious in showing off their good fortune, right? So I look at somebody, I mean, I hope I wouldn't do that, but let's say somebody looks at somebody and starts thinking, you know, do they deserve that? They're such a show-off. They deserve that good fortune. They deserve so many kids, and they deserve such a nice car. And the same way that when God scrutinizes, that'll often be, you're being judged, and Hashem will determine if you're worthy or not worthy. And chas v'shalom, sometimes we're not worthy. So too, a human being's scrutiny, because the human being is divine, is a way of triggering divine judgment. Meaning, it's not directly that the Ayin Hara hurts you, but the Ayin Hara triggers the process of scrutiny where God will look into you to see if you deserve something or not. Now, if you're a perfect tzaddik, Ayin Hara is not going to affect you because, yeah, let God look at me, nothing wrong. But for most people, if God looks too closely, we're in trouble. So Rav Dessler says, Ayin Hara is the triggering of divine scrutiny by a human being looking into my affairs too closely. You understand that? That's what Rav Dessler says the idea is. And that is called the koach of Ayin Hara. Now there are many sources that say Ayin Hara is a potent reality, that one needs to be very, very careful. And in fact, here in Yerushalayim, just a short distance away, there is a woman who apparently has, I mean, I cannot vouch for this, but she has letters from rabbis, etc. She's called the Ayin Hara Lady. I think her name is Miller, Adel Miller. And she has a whole Masorah tradition that if you feel that you have blockages, you know, you're not achieving something, you don't have a shidduch or whatever it is, she cooks lead on top of a stovetop, and if the lead forms certain ugly configurations, that's a sign you have Ayin Haras on you, and she has some procedure to take them off. Again, does not make a lot of sense to me, but these things are done. But the one thing I will tell you about Ayin Hara is you are also correct, that there are many, many sources that say that you are vulnerable to Ayin Hara if indeed you believe in it and you're scared. But in the event you don't heed it, it has no power over you. It's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy. And certainly in the Litvisha Torah world, I don't want to say for sure that people deny Ayin Hara, but we basically go with the Mahalich, that the best protection against all of this is our Torah and our mitzvos, and we don't look for shortcuts like lead boiling or red bracelets or red strings. We look at Torah and mitzvos as our best protection. Of course, I'll tell you one little story about Ayin Hara. Okay, I love the story. A person, I think I may have said it before, a person went to Rav Aryeh Leib Steinman, he should be well, and said he had to buy, and he had to, you know, he was a businessman, he needed a new car. So he had to buy a new car, but he was afraid that in Bnei Brak, which is not a rich city, it's a poor community, people would see his new car, and he would be subject to Ayin Hara, because people would be jealous, and there would be an Ayin Hara on him. So Rav Steinman looked at him and said, have you finished Shas? So he said, well, no. He says, do you learn every day? He said, well, not every day. So Rav Steinman looks at him straight in the eye and says, so why would people be jealous of you? What is there to be jealous about? You know, so the person got the idea that, you know, that maybe there's no Ayin Hara on things that are intrinsically not so important. But again, the ultimate behavioral mechanism that we use is to be modest and reticent about our good fortune, and in that way we are somewhat protected from Ayin Hara. Yeah.
The Mepharshim explained that the incident with Dinah happened to Yaakov because he hit her when he met with Esau.
Yeah.
And so because maybe he would have met her and he would have made tshuva, possibly made tshuva. So. And therefore, she was that it is going to happen because she didn't do that. So my question is: number one, how can she be punished for something, a mistake her father did? And number two, if it's a mistake, I mean, what kind of father would give his daughter to the biggest Rishayim we ever know? So
that's an excellent question. You know, again, everyone remembers this, that when Dina was raped, was seized by Shechem. So Rashi brings the Chazal that this was a punishment because Yaakov put her in a box. He kept her away from Esav, And because he kept away from Esav, God said, she'll have somebody even worse. This thing will happen. And there are a lot of questions. He asked two questions. So I'll take the second question first. And that is, wait a second here. Esav was a Russia. I'm supposed to let my daughter marry a Russia, and God's going to punish me because I didn't marry her off, you know, to the worst guy that existed. That's what I'm supposed to do. Right? I'm supposed to try to get my daughter to marry a good, a righteous person. So the answer to that is, yeah, it's a very good question. And certainly for most of us, if we would do like Yaakov, that would be 100%. But the two answers that the Mefarshim give is, number one, that the koach of Dina, as a daughter of Yaakov, was so powerful and so great that she could even have changed an Esav. So for most of us, as great as my daughter might be, you know, I wouldn't trust her to marry an Esav and change him. But Dina was great enough, she could have changed an Esav. And therefore Yaakov was considered at fault for not allowing that. Now the second answer is a little different. The second answer is from the Altar of Slobodka. The Altar of Slobodka says the following. What Yaakov did was 100% right. Of course he's supposed to keep Dina away from Esav. But Yaakov had a certain personal glee that I get to stick it to Esav once again. In other words, Yaakov should feel sad that Esav is a Russia. Yaakov should not have a little bit of simcha that, I took away my brother's birthright, and I took away his blessing, and now I'll take away his wife. And therefore the Altar of Slobodka said, the problem is not with what Yaakov did, but the problem was that on some level, maybe a very tiny level, there was a certain personal satisfaction that he's getting Esav yet another time. And again, it could be very, very subtle and very, very small. But for that, HaKadosh Baruch Hu holds the tzaddikim to the highest level. Now, your first question was, okay, let's assume, me'eza tam shiyiya, Yaakov Avinu committed a sin. Okay? Why should Dina, but Dina is the one that suffers here. I mean, Yaakov suffered too, but Dina is the primary one who suffers. So the short answer to that, and this is a hard thing to accept, and that is Chazal say over and over again that when children are still minor children, Dina was not an adult yet, she was still a child. The halacha is that small children are considered to kind of be the property of the parents in some ways, and therefore God forbid, children below bar mitzvah or bas mitzvah can suffer for the sins of the parents. That is why at a bar mitzvah, a parent, and Shiloh, some people say a bas mitzvah, it's interesting, why not a bas mitzvah, but parents say a formula, Baruch Sheptarani Me'on Shoshal Zeh, blessed is God that has released me from this person's punishment. Now, some people think that means, oh, thank God I'm not responsible for him anymore. No, but I like this pshat. This pshat that Avudram says, which is very beautiful. Thank God he will no longer be punished because of me. Because once he's an adult, he doesn't get punished for my avarice. So the father is not saying, thank God I got rid of this kid. The father is saying, I can breathe a sigh of relief that my averos are not going to hurt my child anymore. So that's something to be very, very aware, that God forbid, a person's averos can affect his minor children in that way.
This is a short question about, I was working on a trip and we took them to this Katsutrin Talmudic village. They showed this video, and they spoke about the story of Elisha ben Avuya and Rabbi Meir.
Yeah.
And I was wondering why it was that, like, Rabbi Meir had to tell Elisha ben Avuya, you're about to go out of the Tchum, instead of Elisha knowing himself, oh, I'm about to...
Mean the other way around.
Seemingly, Elisha told to say, I'm about to leave Tchum, I'm going to stop here. But instead, Rabbi Meir has to tell him, you're about to leave Tchum. I know it's a nice story because it basically says Rabbi Meir is still counting and he still doesn't want other people to...
You're reversing the names. I mean, Elisha ben Avuya told Rabbi Meir, you're about to...
Yeah.
Why wasn't Rav Meir counting?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, first of all, you know, it could be Rav Meir was counting, but he was going to stop. I think the point of the story is a larger point, meaning we don't have a raya that Rabbi Meir would have violated the Tchum.
Yeah.
But the Gemara wanted to make the point, which is really very, very unusual, that as bad as Elisha ben Avuya was, he did not want to be machshel Rabbi Meir. And that's really a tremendous tribute to a person that even when he became a Rasha, because often when people go off the derech, They want to bring other people with them. And Elisha ben Abuya knew that his mistakes were so serious, and he felt he couldn't do tshuva. He felt he couldn't do tshuva, but he didn't want to be Machshel Rabbi Meir. But again, as I say, I don't think we have a raya that Rabbi Meir himself was going to be Nichshel. He's going to walk up to the limit. Elisha ben Abuya sees it, so Elisha ben Abuya starts saying something. But it's a good, it's a very, very beautiful, powerful story. Elisha ben Avoya, we know, is referred to in many places in Chazal as Acher, the other one. So Rav Soloveitchik used to say that the reason he was called Acher is because it wasn't the real him. It was like almost like a demon took him over. And therefore, it's almost like a Lima Tzuchus a little bit, meaning his panemius was still good, even though he was taken over by another spirit. Yeah.
I heard that it might not be in the year 5776, that it might be like 59 something.
Really? okay, yeah, I think I know what you mean. Yeah. Yeah, wow. Closer than we think.
Closer
huh?
than we think.
Okay, Baruch Hashem. Well, I shouldn't say that. There actually is a Gemara where one of the rabbis said, I hope for Mashiach all the time, but I hope I won't be alive before Mashiach comes because of the wars of Gog and Magog are going to be so horrendous. Yeah, now there is a minor debate, and then there's a major debate. There's a minor debate, which is minor. Are we in 5776 or 5775? Meaning there is a question of 1 year, because the question is, how do you count year one? Because the world was created in 6 days, right? And then Adam was created on Rosh Hashanah. So is year one the... In other words, was Adam created Rosh Hashanah of year two? And year one are the first 5 days? Or is that kind of year zero and Adam is year one, right? So that's going to be a nafkamina. Are we 1 year ahead or 1 year behind? But your issue is this. Your issue is actually one of the most perplexing issues in Jewish chronology. And let me explain what the issue is. If you opened up a secular book of history, of Jewish history, you will find that the date that is given for the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash by Nebuchadnezzar is 586 BCE. Now, there's a big problem with that. 586 BCE, because according to our tradition, there was only 70 years between the destruction of the first temple and the destruction of the second temple. And the second temple stood 420 years. So that would mean from the destruction of the first temple to the destruction of the second temple is 490 years. You got that? From destruction to destruction is 490. And yet we know, through reliable historical evidence, that the second temple was destroyed in the year 70. So, between 586 BCE and the year 70 is what? 630 years. Chazal only call it 490 years. So you're missing around 150 years. Now, based on this unanswered question.
Where do they get the 580?
I don't know all of the primary evidence, but this is a date that's very much accepted. Now again, some people say that's a secular chronology. We can just reject it. I'm not, but there are good proofs for it. But based on that, there is a question: how do we deal with the missing 150 years? So some say, Rav Schwab once said, he was Chaser, but he once said many, many years ago, that he felt that Chazal deliberately withheld 150 years that they didn't count in the calculation. Meaning the world is actually, everything is 150 years more than the calculations that we have. And he gave reasons for it, that Chazal didn't want to reveal the messianic coming, etc. But he was chosh. At the end of his life, he said, I don't know, he says, I'm not going to give terutzim that don't have a mesorah. So as far as I know, there is no source that actually says we're in the year 5,000, 900 and whatever it is, but the basis for it would be how to resolve the discrepancy of those years. That what Chazal called 420 is actually 600, etc. And that's where you get the difference. Now, again, one answer might be, you know, you have to examine it. Who says we have to accept the 586? You know, the 70 we really can't argue with because that's Kemat definitively established. But the 586, you know, is more speculative, etc. But if you look at, for example, Rabbi Wein wrote some books on Jewish history, as you know. So if you look, he actually discusses this in a long footnote, and he just says that he doesn't have a teretz for this particular problem. Yeah?
I heard that in Shmuel, when David HaMelech is fleeing from Avshalom, that he gets rocks thrown at him, and that in the Gemara it says something about how he becomes the fourth part of the Kisei of Hashem for that.
You mean David, yeah, the book, David HaMelech, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
What is that position? Why does he get that position? Because of what he did.
I'm sorry. You're referring to who becomes the fourth part of the throne?
I thought David HaMelech.
Yeah, David. Yeah, that's correct. Yeah. Well, remember that David HaMelech, towards the end of his life, is pursued by his own son, Avshalom, and as he's leaving Yerushalayim for fear of his own life, a man, Shimi ben Gera, who was an ancestor of Mordechai, is throwing rocks and throwing dirt on David HaMelech, saying, you deserve what you got because you took away the kingdom from Shaul. And Yoav, who is David's general, wanted to kill Shimi ben Gera. And David said, no, David said, if Hashem did not want me to be humiliated, this wouldn't have happened. And David HaMelech was the example of someone who accepts humiliation and does not turn vengeance. So the midah that gave him that special merit of being almost like a fourth Av, where Avram is like Yaakov and David is number four, so to speak, is based on the midah of what is called a midah that we should try to emulate in our own lives. Hane'alavim, those who are humiliated, Ve'einam ovim, and they don't humiliate back. And it says that they become like the sun in their glory, that God will give them tremendous, tremendous glory and honor. But one question that you might ask is this. So on one hand, David is praised for being so patient when Shimi ben Gera insults him. And he says, don't hurt him, it must be God's will that this happened to me. And yet, if you look at the book of Malachim, the book of Kings, when David is on his deathbed, the last thing he tells Shlomo, his son, is, be sure to get this guy. And what happens is, basically, Shimi ben Gera does get killed by Shlomo HaMelech. Very strange. I mean, so David wasn't so patient. It was like, Lahavdalek, the godfather, you know, take care of him. So, It's a very difficult kasha because it's the opposite. David was so forgiving and so patient. But the Bali Musar give a powerful explanation. Shimi ben Gera deserved to die. It's very similar to what I said about Yaakov. Shimi ben Gera deserved to die because if you're married by Malchus, if you rebel against the king, you are Chai of Misa. But David didn't want to kill him then because at the moment of David's humiliation, he was afraid he would be acting out of personal animosity. And he says, for me to act out of personal animosity and not for the sake of God would make me a murderer. So he waited years and years when all the feelings calmed down. He was no longer acting out of anger. He then said, you know, this person is Chai of Misa and now we're ready to follow the halacha. You know, I knew the... many of you might know or heard of the Busner Rebbe in Harnof. So I know the Busner Rebbe here too, but I was zochet to have a bit of a relationship with his father, the older Busner Rebbe. And he once told a story that his father, who was the first Busner Rebbe, I used to thought when I was a kid, I thought, Busner, what's a Busner Rebbe? Was there a town in Ukraine called Boston or something? No, Boston actually meant Boston. His father started a Hasidus in Boston, Massachusetts, after World War I, for people who lost their Rebbes in Europe, etc. So it became like a Basna Chassidus. Rabbi Gottlieb was a very, very close Talmud of the late Basna Rebbe. But the Basna Rebbe would say that his father did believe in corporal punishment. If you misbehaved, he hit you. But his father would always wait 24 hours. If the child did something wrong, the father would not hit him till 24 hours had passed. Why? Because if you hit your child or you discipline your child, it has to be because that is what is best for the child. If you do it because you're mad, you're upset, then that's a form of child abuse. So he wanted to be sure that he was doing it because this is what the child needed. And even if it was tough discipline, it was done with calmness. It was not done out of anger. And David was acting in the same way. The concept is, he didn't want to kill Shimei out of anger. He wanted to kill Shimei because Shimei deserved to die. That's the din. That is the din. But he wasn't going to carry it out when he was acting out of animosity and anger. That's an important insight. Now, I once told this story somewhere, and a child psychologist had an issue with it. The psychologist said that kids don't remember, little kids don't remember. So you hit a kid 24 hours after they did something, they're not going to, what is that? You know, it seems kind of like arbitrary.
Out
of all right, so there has to be, say again?
So you can rely on the Evan Shlema, which is you just hit him anyways.
Hit him anyway. That's okay. Yeah. If not for this, you know, for, yeah, it's Gemara and Marcus too. Okay. But the Gemara says that the Gemara, because it says, if God forbid a father is hitting a child and a child dies by hitting, falling against something, so the father is putter because he's doing a mitzvah. So the Gemara says, disciplining a child who misbehaves. Says, what if the child doesn't misbehave? He says, no, it's still a mitzvah. No, take care of it. Okay. Yeah.
So we say halacha Moshe and Sinai.
Yeah.
Is that just like we have to have a Muna? And there's got to be, what's the makor? Like, how do we actually understand when it says halacha Moshe and Sinai versus just like, okay, we can't argue, there's no other reason, there's no logic.
Yeah. Yeah, so first of all, the term halacha Moshe and Sinai, I think you're hitting on it, is a more ambiguous term than you might assume. Because sometimes it is used by Chazal literally as an expression for things that have been around a long time. Something might even be drabbanan. But if it's an older enough drabbanan, they say, this is as if it was given by Hashem to Moshe. It doesn't always mean the technical meaning. But when the technical meaning does apply, and it's not that many times, it actually does mean that this is part of the oral law, the Torah Shebaal Peh, that was given directly to Moshe. Meaning we don't derive it from drasha, we don't derive it from the words of the Chumash, but this was an oral tradition. A lot of things are that way. The fact that tefillin are black, that tefillin are square. All of these halachal Moshe Sinai, there's no indication in the Torah about the shape of, even the word tefillin, the shape and what it is and where you, what part of your arm you put it on. All of this is halachal Moshe Sinai. Now the Rambam writes in the Hakdama that some halachal Moshe Sinais are alluded to in the wording of Psukim, and some halachal Moshe Sinais are literally totally freestanding supplementary laws. The Rambam also lays down a rule that on the halacha l'Moshe Sinai there cannot be a machlokas, because if we believe that the oral tradition was unbroken, then it's impossible for me to say there is a halacha and you to say not, because that would imply that the tradition was broken at some point. So the Rambam lays down a rule, there will never be a machlokas on a true halacha l'Moshe Sinai. If there is a machlokas on something that seems to be halacha l'Moshe Sinai, that really means an ancient rabbanan or something like that. But but you are correct. You have to analyze very carefully in every case where the word appears, where the phrase appears. Is it a true halacha l'Moshe Sinai, or is this an expression for something else?
What's the significance of a yard site? Because sometimes you can say, oh, let's say Tachman because it's a yard site, or but there must be some significance and some basis to it. Not just that, but also we have Lag BaOmer, so.
Yeah. Well, Hasidim, of course, look for all sorts of reasons not to say Tachman. It's very, very common. In some Hasidisha Minyanim, they will never say Tachman at all. Because it'll always be somebody, you know, somebody died on some day, every day of the year, and the like, and probably they were righteous. Well, the idea is, like, the idea is, you know, a yard site, though, is a bit of a schizophrenic day. On one hand, you know, yard sites are days of sadness in which we commemorate the deaths of righteous people. According to many, according to the Gemara itself, it is proper to fast on the yard site of a parent. To fast. And we know that the Shulchan Aruch brings that some people had a minhag to fast on the 7th of Adar, which was the yard site, of course, of Moshe Rabbeinu. And we learned with Hasara B'Teves that Ezra died on the 9th of Teves, and Mi'ikar Adin, that should have been a fast, but Chazal didn't want to, you know, since we fast on the 10th, so on the 10th we also fast for the other events, like the translation of the Torah into Greek and the death of Ezra HaSofer. So that's one side of the coin. On the other end, we also find that the days of the Yahrzeit have certain elements of Simcha associated with them. So, for example, Lag BaOmer, which is the yard site of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, is a day of celebration, cutting hair, and the like. We know that many people, again, more Hasidim, they make big kiddushes on a yard site to celebrate, because there is a concept that on the day that a great soul leaves the earth, he reveals much of his Torah and Kedusha, kind of leaves it behind. In other words, instead of Rav Shimon Bar Yochai revealed the secrets of the Torah that time. So there is really both. On one hand, we lose the physical tzaddik, but the neshama becomes more accessible because freed of the body, right? The body separates neshamas, right? I'm separated from you because our bodies are different. But when the neshama leaves the body, it can actually unify itself with all the other neshamas. And that is why Chassidus actually teaches that a tzaddik can have more hashpa'ah in the world when he's dead than when he's alive. Because when he's alive, the body separates. When he's dead, the neshama connects to all of the neshamas. So that's why you have both aspects. I should also say, too, that according to Chazal, every yard site is a yayim hadin for the neshama. Hashem rejudges every neshama on the anniversary of their death. And Rav Chaim Voloshiner explains, what's the point of rejudging a neshama? What does that mean? A person completed his mitzvos and averos when he died. What is the idea? Hashem is rejudging the same thing every year? So Rav Chaim Voloshiner explains, and this is a very, very important thought, that there are ripple effects of our actions that continue indefinitely. For example, you know, we raise our children a good way, then in a sense we have a chelek in all of the good things they do, and their children do, and their children do. Moshe Rabbeinu has a chelek in the mitzvah of every member of Klal Yisrael till the end of time. And if chas v'shalom I was machalel Hashem and I turned somebody off, I'm not only responsible for them, but for all of the good that could have happened had I not turned him off. So every year, HaKadosh Baruch Hu evaluates a life in the context of the ripple effects that it created, but also the ripple effects it could have created and didn't. That's the lesson. In fact, the Vilna Gaon says that's the, you know, the expression din v'cheshbon. Din v'cheshbon means an accounting. Din v'cheshbon. But the Gra is masbir. What is the difference between din, judgment, and cheshbon, calculation? Din is Hashem judging us based on what we did or didn't do, the sins and the mitzvah. Cheshbon is what we could have accomplished had we done good. So Hashem is not only judging us based on the good or the bad we did, but based on the hypothetical good we could have accomplished had we lived our lives another way. That's the cheshbon, that's the calculation. Yeah.
What does Judaism think about owning pets?
Owning pets?
Yeah.
That's interesting. As you probably notice, in the Haredi world, there tends not to be a lot of pet ownership. And many Jews are afraid of dogs. But there are actually historical reasons for that, because the Polish and later the Germans would have these vicious dogs that would attack Jews. by and large, the Gemara seems to be relatively neutral in the sense that it does say you're not supposed to own vicious animals. That is absolutely forbidden. But the implication is that non-vicious animals are considered to be good. And there are prohibitions in the Torah against causing pain to animals. The Gemara even says that Rav Yehuda HaNasi suffered illness for 13 years because once he was walking in the street and a calf being led to slaughter ran over to him and wanted to be protected, and he pushed the calf away and he said, "This is your destiny. Go and be slaughtered." And he suffered excruciating pain, like stomach cancer, which didn't go away until many years later. There was a nest of field mice in his house, and the maid was going to sweep it away, and he said, "Let them stay. Hashem's mercy is on everything." That very second, he got better, because he showed the mercy for the animals. So, I wouldn't say anything against it, and then I would say the following. If pet ownership can teach a child, or an adult for that matter, responsibility and kindness, then it becomes a very positive thing. So it can potentially be a positive thing, but then one has to factor in other factors like Bittul Torah and the like. So I think for kids, pets